and welcome to Rabble Radio, Rabble.ca's weekly audio magazine. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. Rabble has its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you, and every Friday we break it down for you, no matter where or how you're listening. It's a good way to catch up on the news of the week and, as with all Rabble news, look at current events through a progressive lens. This week on the show, national politics reporter Stephen Wentzel speaks with American legal scholar Erwin Kamerinsky to talk about his new book, Presumed Guilty: How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, in which Kamerinsky makes the case that the United States Supreme Court has been far more likely to uphold government abuses of power, including those done by police against racial minorities, than it has to stop them. Kamerinsky is the dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law and a scholar of constitutional law. Right after that, I'll take you through everything you missed this week on Rabble.ca, from COP26 to Canada's new housing minister. For now, here's Stephen.
So to get started, tell me, how did you come up with the book's thesis? How did you land on this idea here?
I've been teaching criminal procedure in law schools and undergraduates for decades. And each time I teach it, I see case after case where the Supreme Court has failed to control the police and, in fact, empowered the police. I see how the Supreme Court is responsible for racialized policing in the United States. I last taught the course in the fall of 2019. And as the end of that semester, I said, I really want to write a book that tells this story, how much the Supreme Court has contributed to the problems of policing in the United States.
Why did you decide to write the book now? Why now?
There's no doubt that there's a huge problem with policing and racialized policing in the United States. And I signed the contract to write this book in January of 2020 and plan to take a couple of years to do it. After the tragic death of George Floyd at the end of May of 2020, my editor said, how quickly can you finish the manuscript? And I worked real hard and got it in the end of October of 2020. And I think all of the events that occurred after the death of George Floyd, the national focus on the problems of police violence, made the book especially timely.
Yes, and for somebody who isn't as deeply knowledgeable in the history of the United States Supreme Court, reading your book definitely helped. Looking at cases like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, coming to understand how precedents set by the Supreme Court have allowed, in some ways, police violence like that to take place. I'm wondering if you can kind of explain a little bit how the decisions of the Warren Court informed the base of your argument in the book.
On the one hand, the Warren Court, which was 1953 to 1969, is the only time in American history when there's been a liberal majority on the court. Not surprisingly, then, it's the only time that the Supreme Court has imposed substantial limits on policing. It was the Warren Court that decided Miranda versus Arizona. It says that police have to give people warnings when they're questioned in custody. It's the Warren Court that said, if somebody's been indicted and there's a police lineup, the suspect has the right to have an attorney present. But on the other hand, it was also the Warren Court in 1968 that handed down Terry versus Ohio, that said that police can stop and frisk individuals without needing probable cause. That's the standard under the Fourth Amendment in the United States Constitution. Instead, the Supreme Court said, an amorphous standard, reasonable suspicion is enough. Study after study in every major city has shown that police use this power to stop and to frisk in a very racially discriminatory manner.
And I'm wondering if you can touch a little bit on that monumental move by the Warren Court to apply the Bill of Rights to the state level. Can you talk about how monumental that move was to any police accountability?
This is often forgotten, especially by non-lawyers who aren't aware of it. Through the first century plus of American history, the Bill of Rights didn't apply to state and local governments. And so it wasn't until 1925 that the Supreme Court said that the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech also limited what state and local governments could do. It wasn't until 1932 that the Supreme Court said that a person being tried for a capital crime in state court, where there's a possible death sentence, had a right to a lawyer. What that means is for the first 141 years of American history, somebody could be tried in state court, sentenced to death, and executed without a lawyer named present. But until the Warren Court, only a small number of the rights in the Bill of Rights have been applied to state and local governments. The Warren Court changed that. I'll give a couple of examples. In 1961, in Mapp versus Ohio, the Supreme Court said, if state and local police engage in an illegal search or arrest, the evidence that's gained has to be excluded. In 1963, in Gideon versus Wainwright, the Supreme Court said, if a person is being tried in state court and there's a possible prison sentence, the person has a right to a lawyer. The government has to provide one. The person can't afford one. Isn't it amazing that for the first 172 years of American history, a state could try somebody, sentence the person to life in prison, and not have to provide the person a lawyer?
You actually went right into my next question there with Gideon v. Wainwright, another powerful decision by the Supreme Court. I'm wondering if you can touch a little bit more on that case's legacy for people who might not understand.
Gideon versus Wainwright is both enormously important, but also enormously frustrating. The importance is, just as I was saying, now anyone who's being tried for a crime in state court where there's a possible prison sentence has a right to a lawyer. The government has to provide for those who are too poor to be able to pay for an attorney. The American system of justice is based on an adversarial system, with the two sides each presenting their arguments to the court. But if one side is a lawyer and the other side doesn't have a lawyer, the system doesn't work. What's frustrating about Gideon is that all too often, the lawyers who are provided aren't competent or so overworked that they can't provide effective representation. The Supreme Court required that the states provide lawyers, but didn't create an enforcement mechanism.
Now, Erwin, last year I had the opportunity to speak with Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated five from the Central Park Jogger case. And in your book, you talk a lot about coerced confessions. And obviously the Central Park Jogger case is infamous for the coerced confessions of the five young men. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how federal legislation enables the injustice of coerced confessions.
The reality is that police have been coercing confessions throughout American history. For too long, they were using physical brutality, but now that they use trickery and psychological coercion, the Supreme Court is writing much less in the way of protection. What's interesting is in 1966, the Supreme Court said that to lessen the coercion of police questioning, police have to give people warnings. Before the questioning begins, the individual has to be told of the right to remain silent, that anything said can be used against the person, there's a right to a lawyer, the government has to pay for a lawyer. But then 2 years later, Congress passed a law saying confessions should be admissible even if Miranda's not complied with. And it wasn't until 2000, 32 years later, that the Supreme Court declared that law unconstitutional.
And in the same vein a little bit, false eyewitness identifications were another huge part, at least statistics-wise, of your book, a big takeaway for me. Can you talk a little bit about false eyewitness identifications being a big part of criminalizing Black lives?
We now know that many innocent people were convicted because of inaccurate eyewitness identifications. The Innocence Project's been responsible for exonerating many people, often on the basis of DNA that shows they didn't commit the crime. Then when we look back at those who were wrongly convicted, time and again we see it was because of an inaccurate eyewitness identification. Social psychologists have long documented that cross-racial eyewitness identifications are particularly likely to be inaccurate, that people are not good at identifying those of other races. And remember, in the context of eyewitness identification, it's often a victim or a witness who briefly saw a suspect. There was great stress, and we know that all of this leads so often to a false eyewitness identification. Between 1986, when William Rehnquist became Chief Justice, and today, there's only been one Supreme Court case even dealing with the issue of eyewitness identification. And that case came down on the side of the police. The Supreme Court has simply ignored the problem of eyewitness identification, and by not imposing limits on the police, have encouraged them to engage in the tactics that lead to the conviction of innocent people.
Now, I'm wondering what kind of challenges you see in disempowering police misconduct in our current makeup of the Supreme Court.
The reality is the United States has the most conservative court that there's been since the 1930s. There are five staunch conservatives in Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. And there's also Chief Justice John Roberts, who, while not that far to the right, is right of center. None of these six justices have ever indicated, they've never expressed a sense of a problem with policing in the United States. They've never expressed a problem with regard to the racialized policing that occurs in the United States. The reality is there's no indication whatsoever that these six justices are going to enforce the constitutional provisions that were meant to control the police.
And I'm also wondering a little bit on the journalistic side of things. I'm wondering, how can journalists better convey that reality to audiences that the Supreme Court's effectively empowering police and their misconduct?
It's so important that journalists tell the stories when unarmed Black people are killed by the police. It's so important for journalists to do the investigative reporting that shows how little control there is for certain kinds of police practices. I think if there had been more journalistic reporting of the problem of police chokeholds, laws would have more quickly been adopted prohibiting their use. There was a Pulitzer Prize-winning story done last year by reporters from Reuters that investigated how lower courts handled suits against the police and how often the lower courts have sided with the police and ruled against the victims.
What kind of changes have we seen, if any, in the United States legislation to either empower or disempower police?
I finished the book, as I mentioned, at the end of October 2020. And at that moment, I was hopeful. I thought the protests that occurred in all 50 states against police violence were going to lead to legislation to reform policing. A bill passed the House of Representatives, the George Floyd Police Reform Act, but then stalled in the Senate. It passed the House of Representatives again this year, and once more it stalled in the Senate. Some state and local laws have been adopted. California adopted a law a year ago that prohibits police from using the chokehold. Many cities have adopted similar laws. California adopted a law that changes the standard with regard to police use of force. Under Supreme Court precedent, police can use deadly force if it's, quote, reasonable. California law now says police can use deadly force only if it's necessary. California recently adopted a law just in the last couple of months that creates an affirmative duty of police officers to intervene if other officers are engaged in violence and misconduct. But there's been a handful of laws adopted in some state and local governments. Not nearly enough has been done. Not nearly as much has happened as I expected would occur.
Now, bringing it back to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, I'm hoping to bring it home. If you could talk about how these two individuals that are often mentioned in your book, how do their deaths tie into decisions that have been made by the Supreme Court?
George Floyd died as a result of a police chokehold. Derek Chauvin put his knee on George Floyd's neck, cut off his breathing for over 9 minutes. In 1982, 40 years ago, the Supreme Court had a case before it, City of Los Angeles versus Lyons, to end police use of the chokehold. It involved a 23-year-old Black man, Adolph Lyons. He was stopped by Los Angeles police late one night for having a burnt-out taillight. Lyons was ordered out of his car. An officer slammed Lyons' hands above his head. Lyons complained that the keys that he was holding were cutting to the skin of his palm. The officer thought that Lyons was, quote, mouthing off and administered a chokehold on Lyons. The officer literally put his forearm around Lyons' neck and choked until Lyons was unconscious. Lyons awoke. He had urinated and defecated. He was spitting blood and dirt. The officer gave him a traffic ticket and let him go. Lyons sued for an injunction to stop Los Angeles police from using the chokehold, except if necessary, protect the officer's life or safety. But the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that Lyons couldn't sue. The court said Lyons couldn't show he personally was likely to be choked again in the future. Of course, by that standard, no one can sue to have the chokehold declared unconstitutional, because no person can show that he or she is likely to choke again in the future. If the court had ended the chokehold 40 years ago, perhaps Eric Garner and George Floyd and many others would have been killed by the police. In terms of Breonna Taylor, the Supreme Court has approved police being able to enter a residence without knocking and announcing first. That's what occurred in the death of Breonna Taylor. Police entered the residence without knocking and announcing who they were. There was a man with Breonna Taylor. He thought they were intruders in the middle of the night. He got a gun. The police saw the gun and began shooting. One of the bullets hit and killed Breonna Taylor. One of the reforms that Congress considered and that passed the House to eliminate so-called no-knock warrants.
And I guess I'm wondering, with so few avenues to address police misconduct in the federal court, because so many cases get tied up locally and in the state level, I'm wondering what kind of suggestions or what kind of thoughts you might have about how in the future we can address and try to combat that police misconduct in the federal realm.
I think it's important to look other than to the Supreme Court. Given the current composition of the court, this isn't a group of justices who are going to use the Constitution to control police. But there can be limits imposed to the political process. Congress can adopt laws. State and local governments, local police commissions can adopt regulations. Also, state Supreme Courts can interpret state constitutions to provide more protection of rights than the U.S. Constitution. Also, the Justice Department has a statute, 42 United States Code, Section 14141, that lets it sue police departments when there's a pattern and practice of civil rights violations. That's been used in a number of cities to bring about meaningful police reform.
You have quite a list of publications here. Among those, the Conservative Assault on the Constitution and the Case Against the Supreme Court. But when we look at your book here, Presumed Guilty, what is your takeaway? Did you learn anything in writing this book? Or what would your main takeaway be from this project?
I, of course, learned a great deal in writing the book. I've been teaching, as I said, criminal procedure and about the police for over 40 years. And yet still, there are many things that I learned that I'm focused on. I'm not sure I realized that for the first century of American history, there were no Supreme Court cases dealing with the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. I was aware of that, but I never focused on it, never thought about why. I'd never really focused on why was it that the Warren Court, the most liberal in history, handed down Terry versus Ohio, that gave the police the power to stop and frisk without probable cause. My takeaway from the book, or maybe I should say what I want readers to take away from the book, is that the Supreme Court has failed to control police in the United States, and that failure has contributed greatly to the problems of policing, and especially racialized policing in the United States.
That's Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, by Erwin Kamerinsky. Thank you so much for your time today. It was, as Adam Winkler called it, revelatory and sobering, but pleasant to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
That was our own national politics reporter, Stephen Wenzel, in conversation with American constitutional law scholar Erwin Kamerinsky, talking about his new book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Thanks for that, Stephen. Now it's time to catch up on everything you might have missed on Rabble.ca this week. I myself was actually away Monday and Tuesday as I moved between cities, but many thanks to former Rabble editor for filling in for me as I filled up and then unfilled many, many boxes. This week at Rabble, senior politics reporter Carl Nirenberg had his suspicions confirmed when Justin Trudeau's government made the sly attempt to bury the news that it had filed an appeal to Federal Court Justice Paul Favelle's September 29th ruling. That ruling upheld a Human Rights Tribunal order that the government pay $40,000 to all victims of the underfunded First Nations child and family welfare system. The government's lawyers waited until the very last minute Friday to announce the appeal, doing so after 5 p.m. so as to attract as little public and media scrutiny as possible, Carl writes. The only surprise in the late Friday afternoon announcement was that the government will suspend its appeal process for a couple of months in order to work on a negotiated settlement with the complainants, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, headed by Cindy Blackstock and the Assembly of First Nations. The newly minted ministers responsible for this file, Justice Minister David Lametti and newly named Indigenous Services and Crown Indigenous Relations Ministers Patty Haidu and Mark Miller, played their cards close to their chest until last Thursday, when government officials reached out to Blackstock and approached her with the intention to have discussions. Blackstock and her partners at the Assembly of First Nations, who have been fighting this fight for First Nations children for 14 years now, they accepted the government's olive branch and are ready and eager to undertake good faith talks. Speaking of the new cabinet, street nurse and housing advocate Kathy Crow weighed in on Trudeau's decision to appoint a new Minister of Housing. Sure, there have been ministers responsible for the housing file before, but until now, there has never been a minister with housing in their title. Ahmed Hassan now takes on that role with the official title of Minister of Housing, Diversity and Inclusion. Crow, having been let down by government promises on housing for decades, remains skeptical. Our country needs a minister of housing, she writes. We now have one in name, but with a catch-all title that suggests some boxes were ticked off in Minister Hassan's appointment. In the media interviews the minister has done since his appointment, Hassan has predictably followed the Liberals' election platform pretty closely on housing. It's what's missing there, though, that concerns Crow. Nowhere in the Liberal platform, nor in Hassan's interviews, has she heard the term social housing. Quote, we will truly have a minister of housing if the minister's mandate letter includes funding for social housing and rent geared to income housing, creating a co-op housing stream, providing rehabilitation funds for old housing stock, ensuring that seniors' pensions are increased so they can afford to stay in their homes, and creating long-term care standards so our seniors can be housed safely in their later years, and the same for home care, Crow writes. Also on the site this week, our coverage of COP26 continues as world leaders meet in Glasgow at the United Nations conference happening there. Brent Patterson writes about how the Prime Minister's promise to cap Canada's oil and gas emissions, which he announced at that conference, will do nothing to stop the criminalization of Indigenous land defenders. Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan point out that because of vaccine apartheid and the UK's obstructive visa requirements, COP26 is the whitest and most privileged of the United Nations climate summits since 1992. They speak to some activists who are on site there trying to change things. Plus, two Indigenous films, one a documentary on how one reserve is handling the opioid crisis, are reviewed by Humberto Da Silva and Doreen Nicol. Da Silva reviews Portrait from a Fire, a small award-winning film that follows a First Nations youth on a supernatural journey to unravel his family's secret tragedy. Portraits from a Fire is being screened in select Canadian theaters starting November 1st and will be released through Video On Demand on November 9th. Nicol reviews the documentary film Jimabi Bitsin, The Meaning of Empathy. Jimabi Bitsin, the Blackfoot word for giving kindness to each other, is a concept that's key in reducing deaths from drug poisoning in the Kainai community in southern Alberta. Filmmaker L. Maya Telfeathers tells the story of the opioid crisis and how through harm reduction, compassion, and decolonizing recovery, the community has begun to heal. That film opens today, November 5th, in Vancouver, with screenings scheduled across the country throughout November. Also in arts and culture this week, sex worker columnist Natasha Darling looks at the many ways sex workers contribute to pop culture. From the movie Zola to Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion's music, sex workers are most accurately represented when they themselves are in control of how they are depicted, Darling argues. Finally, last Friday, V.S. Wells took a look at how Canada media is importing British transphobia. It started with Toronto Star columnist Rosie DiMano, writes Wells. Her October 16th piece claimed gender-neutral language in healthcare erased women. It's not a particularly new or interesting take, Wells noted, and one that's been thoroughly critiqued over the years, but the Star gave the piece a full page in the news section, despite it actually being an opinion piece. The online article also received a traffic boost when it was controversially tweeted by Margaret Atwood on October 19th. A few days later, Atwood shared another article, this time from the CBC, decrying the toxic in-your-face activism of trans rights activists. The opinion piece was written by a trans woman, Jessica Triff, but was filled with transphobic talking points. Triff implied that trans people who do not transition medically are, quote, risks to women's safety, and that the label trans woman should only be used to refer to someone who has gone through therapy, hormone therapy, and sex reassignment surgeries. Finally, there was also a CTV investigation into trans children and youth who are seeking gender-affirming medical treatment. That story relied heavily on the stories of two cis women in the UK who identified as trans men before retransitioning back to live as women, in order to argue that trans-affirming youth healthcare in Canada is too easy to access. This sudden resurgence in feminist-cloaked anti-trans media rhetoric is probably due to that strategy's success in the United Kingdom, which is Wells's home country. Wells breaks down the differences between American and British transphobia and why we've been seeing a heightened degree of transphobia in Canadian media in recent weeks. You can find all of that and much more at rabble.ca, where, as always, we're bringing you the latest in political, social, and arts and culture reporting, opinion, and analysis. That's our show this week. Thanks so much for listening. If you like the show, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can rate, review, share it with your friends. All of that takes a mere few seconds, and in doing so, you're supporting independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels. We're on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and our handle is @RabbleCA. Do you have any feedback for the show? Get in touch anytime at editor@rabble.ca. I can't promise I'll respond every time, but I do read everything you write in, and I'd love to hear if you have any ideas for future shows or interesting stories of people in your community making change. That's the sort of stuff here at Rabble we'd love to hear about. I'm your host, Chelsea Nash. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks to our new podcast producer, Brianne Doyle, Stephen Wenzel for his reporting, Carl Nuremberg for the music, and all the journalists, writers, and contributors who made this week's content at rabble.ca possible.